Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with polling maestro Nate Silver about his new book, The Signal and the Noise, why so many predictions fail, but some don't.
If something is 95% or more likely to occur, you call it true, and otherwise it's uncertain or too close to call.
Carl Sagal shares her insights on some big developments in the world of book publishing. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Well, as we get closer and closer to the election, everybody wants to know what the Times' great Nate Silver has to say and what he thinks. He's also written an important new book that takes a broader view of a lot of the issues people are discussing today. It's called The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. It's reviewed for us by Noam Scheiber, who says this could turn out to be one of the more momentous books of the decade. I'm delighted that my colleague Nate is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Sam.
All right. So you're the brilliant numbers guy. Everybody knows it. But you are skeptical about the art or the science or what the humbuggery of prediction. Why is that?
Well, and you see this right now in the way people try and look at political polls and other information about the election, where the idea is that we get more information and we get closer to the truth. More information is always better. In practice, in politics, things have gotten a lot crazier when people have so many different ways to consume information. They tend to consume it in a way that confirms their biases or the narrative they want to tell about the race. And so it's reminded me of the thing we talk about in the book, is that which is that we need better skills and tools for how we process all this data that we have. Otherwise, we'll kind of become, I think, suffer from information overload and not really have any strategies to get better at making predictions and really understanding the world around us.
Yeah, you do, in fact, say in the book that maybe there's just too much information. We haven't really learned how to process it. Where does that trouble begin? Does it begin, we'll look at this sort of hierarchically, at the very top of the culture where analysts, people who do know mathematical models and such, actually are themselves overwhelmed by all the variables and factors, the numbers available to them?
Well, what's funny is that people in different walks of life have the same biases exhibit themselves in different ways, right? So in academia, for example, you might have the bias toward overrating the importance of conclusion that you might reach because it might make a better journal article. In television punditry, you might have the tendency to simplify things in a way that doesn't really convey the complexity of the problem that you're trying to focus upon. And in kind of everyday walks of life, we like the idea of kind of a gut feel decision, a quick fix, right? Trust your instinct. And that's true for a lot of everyday things, but for more complex types of problems where there's a lot of information, our instincts often betray us, where our first instinct is usually fight or flight. Yeah, you make a decision very quickly based on a limited amount of information. That's good in an evolutionary sense, right? But we're presented with so much information and data today that those instincts don't often work very well when it comes to trying to forecast the stock market or an election, and it leads us to see patterns in what I'd say is random data, the noise in the data for a signal.
Yeah, why don't you explain briefly, Nate, what the difference is between signal and noise? Because this is a concept that comes up a lot. James Glick has it in his book as well. But briefly, what is it about?
So the term comes from electrical engineering, where noise represents interference, and the signal is the true sound you're trying to transmit so people can hear it. And of course, when you're doing data analysis, the noise is all the randomness, all the irrelevant information, all the clutter, right, that obscures the true signal that you're trying to find. So in polls, for example, if you look at maybe the broad trajectory of political polls over the past, after the Denver debate, for example, they showed a very clear signal toward Mitt Romney. Maybe one poll would be a little bit noisier, right? But sometimes the signal isn't as clear, often because there is none. Often random data is just random. We mistake it for actually exhibiting patterns. And then we kind of tend to trip out on the noise, really, and see meaning in it when there's none there.
And Nate, particularly germane this week for New Yorkers and others in the Eastern Seaboard, you also have some pages, some discussion of climate change in this book.
So we talk about climate change, and we talk about weather forecasting as well. And the weather forecasters are heroes of the book. In many respects, they're dealing with a very complex system, the atmosphere. But they've chipped away at it, and every year their forecasts get a little bit better. So 25 years ago, if you had a hurricane sitting in the Gulf of Mexico, the best they could do was to predict where it would land within 250 miles within a radius of the actual landing spot, which meant that anywhere from Houston, Texas to Tallahassee, Florida was in play. Now they get those storms right within about 100 miles on average. If you look at the forecast that was made 4 days before Hurricane Sandy made landfall
in New Jersey. Yeah, tell us about it. How good was that?
It was
forecast?
Almost perfect, right? It almost nailed the county where the storm actually came ashore. Of course, the storm's so big that defining where's the eyewall, even that gets a little bit tricky. But they predicted 4 days before it did that the storm would barrel into New Jersey, and as much tragedy as there's been in terms of loss of life and property. This is a disaster that the weather forecasters help people to prepare for. Of course, people might not have listened, right? They're like, oh, I survived. I have people talking at the Shake Shack the day before the storm hit about, oh, we survived Hurricane Irene. There'll be no problem whatsoever. We're veterans now, right? And then, you know, people don't realize that some of these storms pack more of a punch than others do. But the weather forecasts are good at telling us, at the very least, where the storms will hit and giving us a good general sense for what the after effects might be.
Nate, you know, it's interesting you bring up those, and I saw many of them, heard them interviewed as well, residents who consciously decided they would not evacuate their homes, and many would say, well, Irene was supposed to cause this tremendous damage. It didn't. Well, it did cause lots of damage, but not in their particular area. And I wonder how much of that skepticism is also innate in us or ingrained, so that we even at some point in some way aren't quite sure about a guy like you who comes at us with a lot of numbers, a lot of models. Is that a healthy skepticism?
Well, I think part of it has to do with this fact that for big major events like elections or like hurricanes, you don't reach the long run very quickly. You only get very limited examples. So maybe in some cosmic sense, all the stuff they tell you to prepare for a hurricane, get a flashlight, right, and you know, put water in your bathtub, all that other stuff, right? Maybe you only need to actually use that one time in 10. So if you have 10 hurricane scares over the course of your lifetime, you're really going to appreciate that one time when you are prepared. But the other 9 times, you'll say, oh, that was pointless. I've survived this storm before. People are not very good at hedging their bets. They're not very good at understanding that sometimes you have to make a life decision to avert risk, even if that risk is unlikely if the costs are high.
And if we look at the return to the election for a moment, there was an interesting op-ed essay written by one of the columnists, Charles Blow, today, who is confused or mystified that in an Ohio poll, Barack Obama does much better than Mitt Romney on the question of honesty and candor. He's up by 9 or 10 points. Yet actually, that doesn't necessarily translate into equally as strong a victory, you know, come election day. And Charles wonders whether that points to some kind of complexity in the way people choose their candidates, or whether are we now willing to vote for someone we don't think is honest, is that a plausible argument, or are there just many, many other factors involved?
No, well, look, a lot of people are deciding on the basis of their partisan orientation. If they're a Republican, they're going to vote for almost any Republican or a Democrat, vice versa. A lot of people who aren't deciding on that basis decide on the basis of the economy, if they give Obama a passing or failing grade on that. Some people like to return the incumbent power. Some people always want to change. But, you know, the good thing about polls is that they serve as kind of a shortcut for understanding what people will do. Polls are not very good at explaining why people do what they do. If you kind of go back and ask people later on, why'd you make this decision, then people have trouble distilling that into an essence sometimes. During the Republican primaries, for instance, people said that Newt Gingrich seemed very presidential to them, which is not the adjective that I would use to describe Newt Gingrich necessarily, right? But when you had Gingrich supporters, they thought he was best on every attribute across the board. And what really drove that vote, I don't think we know as much about.
And so looking ahead to Tuesday, we have an election really so close that the differences, even in your modeling, seems to fall within the margin of error, right? We really don't know.
Well, see, here's where the margin of error is a concept that comes from a Siskel paradigm where you define true from false at a 95% probability, right? That if something is 95% or more likely to occur, you call it true, and otherwise it's uncertain or too close to call. And I, in the book, talk about my experience playing poker and following sports, and we need more of a spectrum of probability. We need that full spectrum from 0% to 100% to succeed in a game like poker, or to understand how, you know, the NCAA basketball tournament works and how you have 15 seeds beating 2 seeds now and again. So I think that the odds favor Obama based on the polling in Ohio and other swing states, where if you just kind of color up all the states blue, where he's ahead in the polls by more than a point or two, and they add up to, I think, 271 or 277, depending on whether you count Iowa on that list or not, and that gets him just past 270 threshold. It could go, a lot of things could happen on election day to change the result. The polls can be wrong, but as a guy who's used to setting odds, I think Obama's the odds-on favorite to win another term.
Well, you certainly did well enough in 2008, and that's one reason you're here with us.
Yeah, so there are a number of ironies where you're kind of writing this book and encourage people to be skeptical about the way they view predictions and predictors, I guess. And yet, you know, I'm someone who has achieved a lot of success through a combination of hard work and luck, pretty much, right? So either way, you know, if we have Romney as the underdog, if he wins, you know, I'll tell people, well, the underdog's supposed to win some of the time, right? That's why we give him a 20-25% chance. But I know some of that positive karma will be reversed. So it's easier to be a critic, I guess, right? And write the book than just kind of do this yourself and be in the heat of the fire sometimes.
Thanks so much, Nate.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Nate Silver, whose new book, The Signal and the Noise: Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't, is reviewed in this week's book review. My heroic colleague, Parul Sehgal, is here to talk about some big developments in publishing. But first, how long did it take you to get into work today amidst hurricane, tropical storm, Sandy?
Took me 2 hours. But again, I have to admit, I'm not in the best of shape. But I did. I walked over the bridge.
Which bridge?
The Manhattan Bridge.
So you live in Brooklyn.
Just to be on this podcast.
Whoa.
I'm going home right after. Sam,
you walked the whole way.
I did.
Was that exhilarating or at all, or was it just a big pain?
It's a beautiful day to walk, I'm not going to lie. It was, and knowing I was going to come in here and talk about the great merger with you, just, you know, it was just the cherry on top.
Made it worth the walk.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's hear about this merger. It's two really hugely major publishing companies. Which two?
This is a big deal. This is Random House, owned by the German corporation Bertelsmann, and Penguin, owned by Pearson, the British company. And, you know, this is somewhat overshadowed by Sandy. It was announced on Monday, October 29th, and this is going to create the largest consumer book publisher in the world. I mean, it's going to have a global market share of more than 25%, and in the United States alone, it's going to hover around 40% of market share.
So when we say that, Parul, just to lay this out for listeners, so two giant companies, Random House, which I think is already the biggest, and Penguin, which is one of those five or six enormous companies you hear about, are actually joining forces. They're becoming one big company. And when you say 25% or 40% of market share, you mean of all the books sold,
Yeah. They
will control that much?
Yeah.
And why are they doing this?
Well, I think people who've been watching this, analysts say that it's been to some degree inevitable that consolidation had to happen among the big six to compete with Google and Amazon, so that they could save money on, for example, everything from warehousing to printing to distribution, and use that money for marketing and for penetrating emerging markets and maybe creating something that could compete in the e-reader world.
So when you say, Parler, competing with really gigantic companies like Google, what are they competing with them for? Google's not a book publisher.
Well, yet, but I mean, I think the main one that they're going after right now is Amazon, which is controlling everything from how books are sold to how books are read. And now, as they've made forays into editorial, what books are being acquired? So I think that they're really trying to compete as best they can.
And Parl, does this relate at all to the real battle that went as far as the United States Department of Justice between what are now being called the legacy book publishers and Amazon over the pricing of ebooks? Does this give this combined company, Random House and Penguin, more say in how much ebooks will be sold for, since they control so many of those books in the first place?
I think that's a really good point. I think we'll definitely see some of that.
And so how are the other publishers reacting to this? You've got other major publishers. Do they think this is a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it wait and see? Are they expecting to make similar moves themselves?
Yeah, I think they all want in. I think the interesting thing about this merger was that at the very last minute, Rupert Murdoch, his News Corp, which owns HarperCollins, also made a bid for Penguin, and this sort of expedited the deal and made it happen. So I think now HarperCollins is waiting around to see if somebody wants to dance with them, merge with them.
And how will this affect authors? I've heard that some literary agents are grumbling that, well, the fewer publishers, the fewer competitors for the wares they're selling for novels and nonfiction book proposals and such.
Yeah, it's all doom and gloom right now to listen to the authors and the agents. Right now it's really competition between publishers that drives up advances. So what do you do if there are less people clamoring for your book?
And what about employees at these two big companies? You said this will save some money. Does that mean streamlining departments, combining departments, people losing their jobs too?
Yeah, I think that that's right now the concern. Right now they're projected to save about 10%, and most of it is about printing costs and warehousing. But I think it's a fair assumption to make that they're going to want to shed imprints. And those are lots of jobs. And that's a lot of, actually more than just jobs. I mean, it's also a lot of editorial diversity that they're going to be losing in terms of.
And Parla, explain what an imprint is for our listeners.
Imprints are sort of smaller publishing labels
within the bigger
within
company.
The company.
Pantheon at Random House or Crown or these kind of smaller publishers that are part of the larger constellation
absolutely,
of the company.
Absolutely.
And so if they combine forces, then you say, well, Crown has its own promotion and marketing department,
absolutely,
and Penguin has its own, and maybe we can put some of those together.
Yeah. They're going to lose some of the flavor that, people can say like a Pantheon book is different from a Crown book, et cetera. So you're going to also maybe see some more, not even just streamlining, but just, we're going to lose some of the more eccentric choices that some of these, labels would have put out.
And you wonder, too, if will it make it a little harder for newer writers, for first novelists and short story writers, if there aren't those smaller imprints there that will take a chance on their
work?
Yeah,
I think that's what people are really concerned about. I mean, and people are looking to the music business, which has seen consolidation on a massive scale, and saying, are we going to be, looking like them increasingly, where it's just going to be, we're going to take this bet because we know that this author is going to make us.
Well, and the music business, in some ways, is almost non-existent now. There's great record labels that don't exist anymore. So this could actually be where publishing is headed.
This is the end.
No wonder you were dressed in black today. Thanks so much, Parl.
Thank you, Sam.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
Glad you could make it in from Darien today. Not so easy, right?
No, the trains are not running north of Stamford, so I had to take it out of there, and then they're all local, but not as hard as it might have been.
And the bestseller list is still thumping along, though I remember at one point there was some concern as to whether the systems would be able to provide us with all the information.
Yeah, they thought that it might have to be curtailed, that we would still run the full list, but that the data set would be a lot smaller because bookstores on the East Coast who usually participate wouldn't be open, wouldn't be able to provide us their information. My understanding is that we were able to reach them and that it's the full list as usual.
So if there are any mistakes, it's all the bookseller's fault. So what if we
always blame the weather.
Always blame the weather. What if we got, what's new in the list this week?
Well, on the fiction side of things, Alexander McCall Smith, who coincidentally goes by the name Sandy, we might just start calling him Superstorm, has a new book, The Uncommon Appeal of Clouds. That's the latest in his Sunday Philosophy Club series. That's new at number 16. Then new at number 13 this week, Kevin Powers' first novel, The Yellow Birds, which was on our cover a few weeks ago. That's an Iraq war novel.
Also a finalist for the National Book Award.
That's right. One of two Iraq war novels that are finalists for that award. That is new at number 13. At number 9, Debbie McComber has a book called Angels at the Table about angels cooking up a plan to reunite a young couple. It's one of a couple of spiritual Christian-type novels on the list this week.
Not an Iraq novel in this case.
Emphatically not an Iraq novel. The second Christian novel on the list this week is at number 5 by a woman named Karen Kingsbury, who's been on the list before. She's a Christian novelist. Her new one is called The Bridge. And it's about an endangered bookstore in Nashville, Tennessee, and the troubles facing its owner. Then at number 4, Tom Wolfe, new on the list with his latest, Back to Blood, Miami novel. Topping the list this week, new at number 1, John Grisham has a new legal novel out called The Racketeer.
And what about nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side of things, there are 4 new titles. Down at number 13, a guy named Greg Smith is new with Why I Left Goldman Sachs. You may remember this book grew out of a very public resignation letter from the investment bank that he published in the New York Times.
As an op-ed?
Yes, that's right. And he complained about the culture of investment banking in general and especially about Goldman Sachs, saying they didn't treat their clients right. And it caused a lot of consternation in banking at the time. Now he's expanded it into a book. At number 7... speaking of very public breakups, the former KISS drummer Peter Criss has a memoir out called Make Up to Break Up. He wrote that with a rock writer, Larry Sloman, who has made the list co-writing some other rock memoirs. This talks about how he joined the group, how he came to leave the group. It also talks about his battle. He is a survivor of breast cancer, and he talks about how little known it is that men can have breast cancer and how he became kind of the public face of male breast cancer. He also settles some scores with his old bandmates. One of the Amazon reviewers notes that pretty much every time Gene Simmons appears in a sentence, the word herpes does as well. Then there's another spiritual book at number 6.
You mean even more spiritual than the last?
Even more. a guy named Eben Alexander, who's a neurosurgeon, has a book out called Proof of Heaven about his near-death experience when he was in a coma. And then topping the list this week is another rock memoir. It's really just the season for rock memoirs. Besides Peter Criss from KISS, there's still Pete Townsend on the list at number 11, Neil Young on the list at number 12. And the highest ranked new nonfiction this week is the autobiography Rod by Rod Stewart, who's now 67 years old.
There seems to be a pattern here. These are not just rock stars. These are old guys rock stars.
They are rock stars from the 60s and 70s, and they've reached a point in their career where they are looking back and telling the stories that the tabloids once told.
Right, and in fact, they have ample clippings, presumably, from the tabloids to include in the stories.
Yeah, in fact, Rod Stewart addresses head-on in his memoir the rumor that spread during the 70s that he had once had to have his stomach pumped after performing oral sex on a room full of British sailors. And he says this was spread by a disgruntled publicist whom he fired, whose great skill as a publicist was that he could make anything up and make it believable.
So Rod's saying this didn't happen.
Rod is saying that not only has he never had oral sex with a room full of British sailors. He's never even had his stomach pumped.
Well, that's probably more surprising. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.